Implementing significant changes, be it in a business, a social situation, or your home, is rarely easy. Even those who will benefit the most often struggle taking on a new environment. It's not just a change in circumstances, it is the change in the things you need to learn and do in the new way about going about doing things. COVID-19 has forced people to change their situation because of restricted mobility. Is there some good that could come out of this? Professor David Hentscher suggests there is some positives if we are prepared to grasp the opportunity, and he has written an opinion piece on this. And he joins us now. David, thank you very much for this opportunity.
It's a pleasure to be here, David.
Now, working from home, and just talk about working at the moment, that's been around for a long time, has it?
It has indeed. We've been talking for many years about telecommuting, typically 1 or 2 days working from home, and even compressed work weeks to some extent have an implication that there's a day at home where you either work or do other things. But yes, it's been around for many years, and it's been shown many, many times that it's one of the best instruments we have to try and reduce the traffic on our roads.
Well, of course, we've often used big build, haven't we? That's a pretty expensive and not necessarily effective way to go about doing it. Is that a balance we've got to come to grips with?
I think it is. I think it's interesting that up until very recently, we talked about the need for road pricing reform as the only real way that we can try and tame the traffic, and we just can't build our way out of it. But now we have another opportunity, which has always been there, but it's interesting that now employers and employees are starting to see some merit of the working from home idea.
Yes, employers is a critical issue, as is politicians and the general management attitude. Do you think those are the things that have held us back in the past?
Absolutely. In fact, what COVID-19 has done has given us a real market test as to whether these things may or may not work. Of course, under quite extreme circumstances. And if you look at Transport for New South Wales, where typically 500 people used to work from home, not every day, but a fair bit, there's over 10,000 doing it now. And it's interesting that the Secretary, Rod Staples, said as recent as yesterday that, in fact, Transport for New South Wales will be looking very seriously at allowing more people to work at home, provided that still maintains some element of productivity and recognises the essential jobs that will require face-to-face. But importantly, the new challenge in transport is not to flatten the curve, but to flatten the peak.
Oh, okay, it's lovely that there's less traffic on the road, but what do you mean by flatten the peak?
Peak hour traffic congestion in the peak and crowding on our public transport. They're both pretty bad and have been. If we can use working from home as some sort of instrument to reduce the number of people that are travelling at typically in the peak, because many commuters do, then it won't take many if, for example, we could have 20% of people working from home one day a week on average, but not always on a Monday or a Friday, but spread through the week. A 20% reduction in the number of commuters out and about, both in their cars and in public transport, is enough to break the severe elements of crowding and traffic congestion. So it's not just the volume, it's the time of day in which you can achieve it.
Well, quite often we spend the most money trying to cope for the peak. Is that part and parcel of bringing about a more cost-effective solution?
It is indeed. It's not just cost-effective. It's a productivity gain. In fact, I had a meeting today with various colleagues, and I asked them to put a hands show on Zoom as to who believes they're more productive when working from home, and most put their hands up. The constraint, of course, David, is those who do not have the right home environment in terms of a room where they can shut themselves and work without being disturbed by kids, etc. So we've got to look at the whole package challenge. Of course, opening schools, kids staying at home, all that sort of stuff does have an impact on the extent to which the work environment at home is actually as productive than the one at work. But let me emphasize that we're not talking about a black and white solution here. We're talking about shades of gray, in that people will still need to go to work to some extent, even if it's not essential they go to a physical workplace location for other reasons. Socialization, the feeling of getting out and interacting, and those ad hoc meetings that turn out to be productive. So we definitely have a new opportunity here to break the back of some of the big transport challenges through reviewing the extent to work to which working from home will be accepted by both employers and employees. And if necessary, I see no reason why government should not be interested in providing some subsidy. After all, they'll be saving money on infrastructure and services.
We'll come to the government, but it's not an all or nothing. It's not even one day, even if you delayed the peak. Is that part of what you would consider a good outcome, although we're 100%, as it were, at the moment, merely to adjust in, as you say, 20% of the time, would be a huge gain? How much of a gain do you think that would be to the community?
Well, in terms of network performance, because there's many KPIs we need to look at, even 20% is much, much greater than what people have even predicted with road pricing reform, and indeed building our way out, which seems to always return it to another number after a decent reduction in the improvement in the speed of, say, 10% if you're lucky. So the answer is that working from home can be a much easier way of improving network performance, as long as we get the support from employers and employees. So in other words, it's a win-win, and it's taken a pandemic, unfortunately, to prove the case that it has real legs.
It's often that we are pushed into these things, but it makes us do things like get a better computer and a webcam at home. Is getting technology up and running takes a little bit of time, but the catastrophe, the pandemic, has given us the situation where we have to work through the initial barriers to get the long-term benefit.
Absolutely, and it's interesting to notice that one of the highest purchased products since the pandemic has been technology, where many shops have run out of computer screens, things like that. And so what we're also going to suggest, and there's got to be a lot more research into this, is the implication this has going forward in the design of residences. But of course, you can still have local workplaces in terms of, you know, these locations that people can go to and have a room they would sit in, which is a lot like what many businesses do anyway with hot desking and so on. So I think the important implication here is that if someone does work from home, there might need to be some support from employers, especially on ensuring that the support technologies are there, and that there is a financial advantage in working at home as well, not an impost. Some people have said that their electricity bills will go up because they'll be spending all day at home on their computers, etc. It may be true, but I suspect that's nothing near to the money they would spend on public transport, on cars, on tolls, and so on.
What must the political process do to encourage this?
I think there are two things. One, it's related to information, is to show through solid factual evidence that there are some enormous benefits in having a certain amount of working from home, benefits to the employer, and also maybe lifestyle benefits to employees. I think it's got to start with government pushing the argument that everybody can learn and benefit from the recent experience, and it's not all bad. One of the great concerns also is that employers, many of them, may stop thinking about the notion it's got to be 9 to 5 and you have to be physically together. And I think it needs to be reinforced that even your competitors are not doing that now, so don't worry, but to prove that you get a productivity gain, and that more than offsets all these other concerns, in my view.
That's a question of what we measure, really, isn't it? Often transport is measuring volumes, yet in many ways it should be measuring behaviour, even a level of satisfaction and contentment, if I may go that far, that business has told us that can produce better outcomes as well. Do you think that we might move more to a way of measuring an understanding of behaviour, not just volume?
Absolutely. But of course, all the good transportation planning methods do focus on the fact that ultimately we need to understand how people make choices. But we also need to understand that those who travel on the road as commuters, for example, are often influenced by some constraints imposed on them by their employers. So we need to make sure that the changing behavioural patterns of employers are also being shared into the responses of employees in the way they make decisions. So many years ago, David, I did a study looking at the relationship between telecommuting and what the employee would like to do and what the employer would like to do. It turned out very interestingly that many employees, because it was an interactive experiment between the two types of people, tended to prejudge what the employer would say and assume that they would not be allowed to telecommute and said they would not wish to telecommute. It turned out that many employers do not have that view, and they would have supported it if the employee had asked. So in other words, information, the lack of communication between the affected stakeholders can actually make a huge difference to resolving this. And I think today, let us hope that when people start physically going back to work, they ask their employer, "I work really well at home. Do you think it's something we should talk about as a possibility of doing to some extent in the future?" I think David, that's a really important question.
David, you're very strong at measuring consumer choice. Sometimes we don't understand what those choices might mean. Do you think this has given an opportunity? How much of an opportunity has this given to understand in a real sense what the alternatives might mean?
Look, I absolutely agree, David. It's the best experiment we could have ever wished for, as nasty as it is. It's a bit like the medicos are now so busy trying to come up with a vaccine and do trials, which they would never have got round to the same extent before. And so I think that what we now have been offered is a real opportunity not to miss, to test this.
David, thank you very much for your time. I've pushed your time limits and I appreciate it greatly. Thank you.
It's a pleasure, David. My phone just went off with a reminder to talk to you.
I thought that might have been the next Zoom call.
No, it wasn't. I apologise. It was my mobile. I don't know why. I've got this. I think it's since I put that COVID tracking thing on. I think it keeps reminding me to look at something, you know?
Well, I've just been in a car that it kept constantly talking to me about the speed limit, even when it got it wrong. But that's another issue.
That's for another day. But, you know, one of the things that's really... There's a lot of unintended consequences, and not all bad, but you know some are, of course, is that the real challenge for us here is going to be what's going to happen with the use of a car, because biosecurity is now the new attribute in a mode choice study, which is, of course, health risk and people perceptions about the risk, which is going to go on for a long time. So there's got to be an issue about especially if we go to electric cars that are being pushed, less expensive, more efficient on energy, there could be a boom in car use on the road, which could be a problem without reform pricing. On top of that, made worse by the fact that I think in the longer term, if not even in the short term, government is going to be redesigning the configuration of their public transport, or at least removing seats and things so that people have social distancing in the vehicles. For some time to come, or having some sort of control mechanism for how many are going to be allowed on a train carriage, for example. That's definitely going to happen, in my view.
Yes, there's certainly situations that I think that the design of vehicles may take on a whole new meaning as well. Do you think that the impact that we've had, the major impact we've had in reduction of local pollution, may well push us towards electric cars, for example?
Well, I think the relationship between pollution and electric cars is important, but if you look at the life cycle costs of energy, and another piece I wrote that's just been released through our thinking series, you'll find that it depends where the energy is sourced from. And if you're talking about lithium and the coal-fired power stations and what have you, not only have you got the issue of cheap child labour in the Congo, you've also got the many of the energy-related devices coming out of China have got a coal base to them as well. So it comes back to the assumptions we want to make about all sources of energy, not just for end use. Mm. Now, if we went to nuclear, many of those issues would disappear. That's a challenge. So I think we have to be very careful, always talking about end uses. Oh, it looks great, you know, but it's not that great, to be honest. Having said that, Infrastructure Partners Australia are pushing electric cars, and I think their case is even stronger at the moment because of the fact there's likely to be an increased demand for cars, and government will be persuaded by having a cleaner energy, regardless of the source, at the end use. So there's a lot of consequences of what we're going through at the moment, and you know, we've only really started thinking about them, and it's just on and on as a possibility. But what I can say is that we as a set of transport planners and good thinkers need to look at ways in which we can really improve the efficiency of our networks and not miss this as an opportunity.
I think, too, the pollution issue is that while we may think globally, we will act locally, and it's the local pollution, like London's congestion charge and you know, ultra-low emission zones, is a case of that is what is very apparent to us and so can give us both political and public support, political will and public support, to move in a direction, even if it might have... the global impact may not be as strong.
Well, I think so, David. That's a good point. But I think we'll also now have to disconnect any issues to do with energy and air pollution from congestion, because I don't think there'll be as much congestion around. And sometimes we use a congestion pricing scheme as a proxy. Reduced cars, reduced fuel consumption, improved air quality. I think we need to look at the whole issue of efficient energy vehicles. Mm. Separately and not confuse the two, and then we might have a more chance of getting it over the line.
Okay, that's one I would love to talk to you in more detail, but for now, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure, Dave.